The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
Oh, yes, it is. It's a Monday. Welcome to it. I was just trying to type a message in the chat room because Bobby says it's 104 degrees where she is at the YouTube chat room, in case you're wondering. We've got two of them. 104 degrees there. I got to tell you, it's rainy here in South Florida, so it's cool outside. The rain cooled it down. It's only 77 degrees here, and it's 104 wherever Pisces Bobby is. Where are you, Bobby? Anyway, I know it's like something like 118 in Phoenix. Yeah, not anywhere I'd want to be right now. All right, so anyway, it is a Monday, and it's, wow, it's one of those days. So a lot going on. Salt Lake City, Utah. That's, I was just trying to wait until she, 104 in Salt Lake City. That doesn't sound like fun to me. Just saying, doesn't. I've been to Salt Lake. I actually floated in the Great Salt Lake once when I was a kid. Anyway, all right. So let me tell you what's going on today. And I don't know if you've had a chance to read this yet or not, but you should. The Boston Globe last week started publishing a six-part editorial. It's called, and let me get the page up here because I don't want to screw it up because it's really good and I'd hate to, you know, mess it up. Future-proofing the presidency. It says Donald Trump brought our democracy to the brink and exposed its weak spots. How to thwart the next American tyrant. And I don't recall ever a major American newspaper doing this. 6 days in a row, it started the end of last week, they started it on this six-part series. The first installment was A Treasure Map for an American Tyrant. The next one was Who Owns the President? Then A Sordid Family Affair. You can guess where they're going with that one. Hiding the Evidence, Rewards for Doing the President's Bidding, and The Case for Prosecuting Donald Trump. I feel like I'm a guest host of Jeopardy. Who wants to start? I'll take A Sordid Family Affair for 200. Mayim. I don't know who the guest host is this week. I thought Mayim Bialik last week was very good. Anyway, so we're going to speak with one of the members of the Boston Globe editorial board in the second half hour of the show. His name is Abdallah Fayyad. Again, he's a writer for opinion writer for the Globe. And we'll talk about this series. And I read it and it all makes sense. The problem is it takes many of the moves, many of the steps that they have to take require, you know, Congress to vote laws in, to change some of the laws. And with this Republican Party, I don't see how that happens. So let me tell you a couple of things that, you know, just to start off the show. I would have started with the story about Mitch McConnell, but we'll get to that in a moment. I just got to say, you know, Saturday marked the fifth anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. You know what? I hate this. I don't know if it's the deadliest or if Las Vegas was the deadliest. Either way, too many fucking people were killed by a madman with a gun. That's what I do know. And so this was the fifth anniversary on Saturday. And, you know, just a fitting marking of the occasion. From Friday afternoon through yesterday, at least 9 people were killed and another 47 injured in 8 mass shootings across 6 states. This is insane. So far this year, we've had 272 mass shootings, and they're qualifying it as 4 or more people shot constitutes a mass shooting. 272 so far this year, and it's only June. We're not even halfway through the year yet. The total number of mass shootings is about 40% higher than at this point in 2020, and about 65% higher than it was in 2019. I, if you weren't already nervous about going out because of, you know, the COVID, I would think that the frequency of these shootings, I mean, so many this weekend, I couldn't even keep track of them. And certainly the news isn't really covering them like a major news story. It's not the lead story anymore. It's, oh, yeah, a number of bunch of mass shootings again this weekend, a bunch of people dead, a bunch more hurt. When does it end? You know, when does it fucking end? I got to tell. So, we were supposed to on this weekend go see this Van Gogh exhibit. I told you about it last week. Saturday, we had tickets for Saturday. Saturday morning, I check my email. It's like, oops, this Van Gogh exhibit has been delayed. I guess it's a new one that was just opening. I didn't realize I got tickets so close to the opening. But we were supposed to go Saturday late afternoon. And Saturday morning, I get the message saying, nope, you need to reschedule. You need to get tickets for later on in the run. Lovely. So we're going July 10th. But that aside, so we had it, you know, we were going to go out. So instead, we decided to go out to dinner. We picked a local restaurant that has a lovely outdoor dining area because I'm still not ready to go inside. And, you know, and we went and it was lovely. We had a great dinner, restaurant called Tap 42 here in Coral Springs. Very nice. And then, you know, I keep reading about all these concerts coming to the area. And as much as I would love to go, I'm not ready yet. And if you wonder why I'm not ready yet, well, let me open up my Twitter right here and quote from Dr. Eric Ding, who's been on this program. Let me see. Do I have it here? Okay. I don't know what. Okay. Here, he wrote, this new Delta variant of the virus is ramping up and it's bad. So Eric Ding, Dr. Eric Feigl Ding, tweeted, outbreak, even with two doses of the mRNA vaccines, that's the Pfizer and Moderna, a Canadian hospital, 16 patients and 6 healthcare staff, Delta variant positive. 6 out of 16 patients and 5 out of 6 healthcare workers had received 2 doses of the vaccine. 7 patients and 1 healthcare worker had 1 dose. 1 patient is now in the ICU. This is bad. This is telling us that we are not out of the woods yet, and people are acting like it's just, you know, go about business as normal. We're over it. We're not over it yet. Seriously, not over it yet. If you don't follow Eric, it's Dr. Eric Ding is his Twitter handle. You should, because, this thread, it's like a 12-part thread that he's writing, but he says, one thing we know, people who are vaccinated, fully vaccinated, nobody who's fully vaccinated has died of COVID, but there are breakthrough cases and this new variant is frightening. In fact, what's his name over in England, Boris Johnson just postponed reopening the country because this Delta variant is coming on strong. So be careful. Don't get stupid. We're doing so well. We could wind up fucked over again. Don't do it, please. You know, be safe, be sensible, wear the damn mask. And if you can avoid it, don't go inside places. I mean, if you're going to go out to a restaurant, eat outside like we did. It was good. But I'll tell you the other thing is, as we sat down, David looked around at where the entrances were. And he said, I don't know about sitting here because if they come in, they're going to come in from there. And there was an entrance that wasn't through the restaurant. It was like an entrance right into the outdoor patio seating area. And they, who he was talking about, was someone with a gun. Because that's part of our reality these days. Anywhere you go, it doesn't matter. You're a sitting duck. Some crazy person who for some reason has access to a gun could kill you. Welcome to America, everybody. Hey, it's Monday. Yeah, no, it's not funny. All right. Now for the story that I would have led with if those other things weren't going on. God damn Mitch McConnell. That's how I start. God damn Mitch McConnell. You know, and the thing is, Democrats don't learn. I'm still reeling from what happened in 2016. You remember this, right? It was February of 2016 when Antonin Scalia died, the Supreme Court Justice. February 13th, 2016 is when he died. Election Day, there was a presidential election that year scheduled for November 8th, 2016. 268 days later. Got that? 268 days later. I think 9 months later, you could make a baby in that time. You can conceive the baby or the fetus, carry the fetus to term, and give birth to a baby. It comes out as a baby. When it's inside you, it's not a baby. It's not a child. It's not a human being. It's a fetus. But I digress. 9 months between the time when Scalia died and the election day. And at that time, you know, Barack Obama's like, okay, I'm going to nominate someone. And what Barack Obama did was nominate the most right-wing person who would be acceptable to some of the centrist Democrats in the Senate, thinking that once again, he's going to do his best to win those Republicans over, because that's what Barack Obama did. Well, he never did, but he tried to do it unsuccessfully for 8 years, and he thought he'd give it one more shot. So Scalia dies, and he's like, you know what? I'll throw a bone to our Republican friends. I'll give them something, someone, I'll nominate a justice that they suggested. Yes, well, I want to say it was Orrin Hatch, but I could be wrong. Don't hold me to that. But it was some Republican senator who suggested to Obama, oh, you should nominate Merrick Garland. He'll sail through easily. He'll get an easy confirmation from Republicans. Well, that apparently nobody asked Mitch McConnell, because from, well, this was about a week, maybe 10 days after Scalia died back in February of 2016, Obama had said, I'm going to nominate Merrick Garland, to a chorus of, really? What? Huh? And then Mitch McConnell said, you can nominate whoever you want. We're not going to give him a hearing.
It's campaign season. We're right in the middle of it. And one of the most important issues now is this. Who will Americans trust to nominate the next Supreme Court justice? Presidential candidates are already debating the issue on stage. Americans are always already discussing the issue.
It was still primary season, by the way.
And voters are already casting ballots
in the primaries.
Case of the Democratic leader's constituents on this very day with this issue very much
in the primaries.
One might say this is an almost unprecedented moment in the history of our country. It's been more than 80 years, since a Supreme Court vacancy arose and was filled in a presidential election year. And that, Mr. President, was when the Senate majority and the president were from the same political party.
Doesn't matter.
The same political party.
Doesn't matter. 80 years. Doesn't matter.
Since we have divided government today, it means we have...
Yeah, okay, so I guess I cut him off because that was enough. Enough for that shit. You got the idea, right? So that was in 2016. They not only wouldn't hold a hearing, they didn't meet with him. None of the senators, none of the Republican senators in the U.S. Senate would even meet with Obama, the sitting president's nominee for the Supreme Court. It was a filibuster of a different sort. And you know what? Obama, to my mind, did nothing. He bitched about it. He complained. They're not going to let me put forth my nominee. I have 9 months left in my term, and they won't even meet with him. Oh, woe is me. Toothless. No testicular fortitude there whatsoever. And so, don't ask me what he could have done. He could have done something. He could have twisted arms. He could have said to Mitch McConnell, hey, Mitch McConnell, you know that bridge that just fell down in Kentucky? You'd like it repaired, wouldn't you? I mean, there are things they can do. Read fucking biographies of Lyndon Johnson. But Obama didn't do anything. And we lost that seat. And Mitch McConnell, once the election happened and the travesty of the century happened and Donald Trump becomes president, of course, they pushed through Neil Gorsuch to fill Antonin Scalia's seat. Lovely. Lovely. Then, when Scalia died, there were 268 days left in Obama's term. 9 months. More than enough time to conceive of and birth a baby. Plenty of time for hearings and to get a justice through. Well, let's fast forward 4 years. This time it's September 18th, 2020. 45 days before the 2020 presidential election. And what does Mitch McConnell say?
The entire Senate is united in thinking of and praying for Justice Ginsburg's family.
Are you?
Most especially her daughter Jane, her
really?
Son James, her grandchildren, step-grandchildren, great-granddaughter, and everyone who called her their own.
Yeah.
Mr. President, I ask consent that the following remarks appear at a different place in the record.
What?
Without,
okay. Now, whoops, hold on. I'm going to pause this right here because what you just heard, this was September 21st, 3 days after Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. Mitch McConnell, that human piece of excrement, on the Senate floor, gave this heartfelt, loving eulogy, kind of, sort of, for Ruth Bader Ginsburg and said that. And then he said, Mr. President, I'm going to ask that the next thing I say be moved in the record to somewhere other than here, because he just spent a whopping, 10 seconds praising the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg and saying how valuable, how important she was and how much she's going to be missed by everybody. And then he says, now please take my next statement and move it elsewhere on the record so you don't hear me say this. Or this. Hold on, this.
President Trump's nominee for this vacancy will receive a vote on the floor of the Senate.
Excuse me? Excuse me? All right, I'm not going to play the whole thing again, but I want you to hear it uninterrupted, to hear how shitty this sorry excuse for a human being is. You know what? I'm just going to play the whole thing because you got to hear it in its entirety. This is not edited. This is exactly how it came out of Mitch McConnell's mouth on the Senate floor, September 21st, 2020, 45 days or 43 days before the presidential election, and 3 days after Ruth Bader Ginsburg died.
The entire Senate is united in thinking of and praying for Justice Ginsburg's family. Most especially her daughter Jane, her son James, her grandchildren, step-grandchildren, great-granddaughter,
and everyone
who called her their own. Mr. President, I ask consent that the following remarks appear at a different place
what
in the record.
What a piece of shit he is.
Without objection.
President Trump's nominee for this vacancy will receive a vote on the floor of the Senate.
And this is after he heard that Ruth Bader Ginsburg's final wish was that they would let the next president name her successor. What a... I got two words for Mitch McConnell after hearing that. Okay, but the story doesn't end there. So today, welcome to today. It's June 14th, 2021. And Mitch McConnell is on the Hugh Hewitt radio show. I can think about the people who would listen to that show for a moment. Okay, not that's enough because, you know, I don't want to make you nauseous or anything. So Mitch McConnell is on the Hugh Hewitt show. And Hugh Hewitt asks Mitch McConnell, hey, what happens if all of a sudden we have, you know, the you guys, the Republicans, take back the Senate in 2022 in the midterms, a distinct possibility. They're tied right now. What happens if we, if the Republicans take back the Senate in 2022 and a Supreme Court seat comes open in 2024? What do you think he said? Come on. All right, I got it for you.
If you regain the majority in 2022 for the Republicans, and there's a very good chance of that happening, I'll come back to the individual races in a second. Would the rule that you applied in 2016 to the Scalia vacancy apply in 2024 to any vacancy that occurred then?
Well, I think in the middle of a presidential election, if you have a Senate of the opposite party
of the president,
you have to go back to the 1880s to find the last time a vacancy was filled. So I think it's highly unlikely. In fact, no, I don't think either party, if it controlled, if it were different from the president, would confirm a Supreme Court nominee in the middle of an election.
You just did!
What was different in 2020 was we were of the same party as the president. And that's why we went ahead with it.
So that's the excuse they're using, because the Senate was controlled by the same party that the sitting president was in. You know, I got this little constitution here. Nowhere in it does it say, you know, the president shall nominate a new Supreme Court justice to replace one who has died. Unless, of course, it's an election year and the Senate is controlled by the same party that the president is in. It doesn't work that way. Hey, Mitch McConnell, I got another song for you.
I just need you to shut the fuck up, cause nobody asked you, bitch. I need you to shut the fuck up, bitch, shut the fuck up, bitch. Just shut the fuck up, bitch, shut the fuck up, bitch. Bow, bow, shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up. Bow, bow, shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up. Bow, bow, shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up.
Bow, bow. The only way we're gonna shut that guy the fuck up is if we continue to vote in the numbers we did in November of 2020. And those were such huge numbers. They were record-breaking numbers. More people than ever voted before voted. And we need to do it again and again and again. And all of these rules that they're changing to make it more difficult for us to vote, that should just heighten your resolve even to make it more important to even vote. So, you know, do not let them take your vote from you. They're trying to take everything else from you. This is just, my head's exploding. I just cannot believe it. I mean, I believe it. It's what they do. It's who they are. I always say when something like this happens, I go, it's unbelievable. And then I correct myself. No, it's totally believable. It just sucks. It's just completely fucked up. But I'll tell you, I got a little bit of sweet justice. 'Cause two things happened. Today happens to be Donald Trump's 75th birthday. One of the worst things that could have happened in our lifetimes, Trump was born 75 years ago today. But Israel gave him a big birthday present. I did a Google search thinking maybe somebody did a parody song for BB Be Gone. BB Be Gone, because BB Be Gone. Let's see. Israeli lawmakers yesterday voted 60-59 to say bye-bye, Bibi. They installed a new coalition government, finally ousting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from power after a record 12 years. And he had served 3 years before that, so it was 15 total, but 12 in a row. So now, you know, I know they often say, be careful what you wish for and, you know, talk about the devil you know over the devil you don't know. I'm willing to roll the dice on this new coalition. It's 8 parties are involved here. There are parties from the right, the center, and the left. And it has the first Arab party to serve in the Israeli government is represented in this new parliament. So although the first guy that comes in, the new prime minister of Israel, is Naftali Bennett. He is an Orthodox, right-wing, leader of Israel's very religious nationalist movement. He used to be a Netanyahu ally. He reportedly is further to the right than Netanyahu. The thing is, he's not ruling the land with his iron fist. He's got this coalition to deal with. And their chief goal in getting these eight parties together to do this was to get Bibi Netanyahu the fuck out of there. And they did. You know, I'm not a singer, but I'm thinking, what's a good parody song? And, you know, I always love Bye Bye Birdie. So, bye bye, Bibi. Israelis got you now. So, I didn't get any further than that. I was just thinking that would be a good song to parody. Maybe I'll get with Lauren Mayer again and write up some lyrics. He's gone. But you know what he did when he left? He started crying. Everything. It's a hoax. It's a fraud. It was a fixed election. Sound familiar? And then he says, we'll be back. Yeah. Netanyahu denounced the coalition that ousted him from office, calling it a weak and dangerous government and saying it would not be able to stand up to global rivals like Iran. And then he said, we'll be back soon. But you know what happens now? See, there's more than just these correlations between him and Trump. Like, we got him out. They got him out. Guess what's waiting for him? Here's the difference. Netanyahu has already been indicted on like 30 counts or something. I mean, a lot of indictments. Part of the reason he wanted to stay in power was because he knows that once he's out of power, he's subject to prosecution. And it's ugly. The charges against him are, you know, corruption, all the same shit that's waiting for Donald Trump. And the thing is, I told you in just a couple of minutes, we're going to speak with someone from the Boston Globe editorial board about this six-part editorial that wrapped up today. So they've been publishing it one part at a time for the last 6 days. Today is the final installment, which is called The Case for Prosecuting Trump. And, you know, there's so many parallels here. And one of the reasons why Donald Trump was so insistent on staying in office, other than the fact that he's a megalomaniac and, you know, power hungry, is, well, twofold. One, all of the charges that are awaiting him, all of the potential prosecutions and the lawsuits that have built up. And two, Donald Trump is broke. He owes somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 million, and all those loans will be coming due over these next 4 years, right after he got out of office. So he's not, he had another ulterior motive other than just the power to stay in office. It was to avoid prosecution. Well, wouldn't it be great if, you know, Biden's talking very quietly, talking about closing Guantanamo Bay. I have an idea. Let's clear it out. Get rid of all the detainees that are there that have been there too long. By the way, Reality Winner was freed today. Just thought I'd throw that in there before I run out of time and forget. That's good news. But get all those detainees the hell out of Guantanamo Bay. They shouldn't be there. And throw Bibi and Donald in together. Just the two of them. Let all the guards go and everyone else. Just make it like, you know, Alcatraz. Give them their own little part of the island and let them live out their last few days there together. I kind of like that idea. Anyway, So looking at the comments in the YouTube chat room, Karate Joe said, yeah, Bennett is probably at least honest. Ish. You know what? He can't be worse than Netanyahu. And as I say that, I'm like, watch what you're saying. I shouldn't go in absolutes. I hope he won't be. And I'm thinking that the others in this coalition will, you know, at least check his worst impulses, right? Because he's not governing alone. Oh, poor Bibi. I got no sympathy there. I did pull up the phone numbers of a couple of hotels in Tel Aviv, thinking maybe we'd call over there. But our guest is going to be joining us any minute now. So, in fact, wow, like magic. So let me tell you about why we're not going to call Israel today. So This six-part series. Ah, you know what? All right. I should have had that down. 1 second, Abdallah. Let me just real quickly. Hi, who's this? Very quickly. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Who is this?
Oh, I'm sorry, Nicole. This is Michael from Memphis. How you doing?
Hi, Michael. I'm doing okay. Real quick, I got a guest standing by, but, you know, it rang, so I'm letting you through. What's on your mind?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm extremely angry. We talked about this the other day. Obama, when he kicked Merrick Garland, yeah. Merrick Garland has no balls because Obama had no balls.
Right, exactly.
The Democrats have no balls.
All right.
When are they going to figure it out? They're not going to work with you.
Right. That's what I've been asking.
And it's frustrating because you see it. And it's like, you guys are full of shit. There's no way you believe these people want to work with you.
Now, of course not. And I don't understand why Joe Biden is still going through the charade. I mean, enough already. And it's not like we have a unlimited time here. We've got an election coming up, and we know what kind of games the other side plays. I don't understand what's going on here.
Yeah, they're ready. They're ready. They're getting ready. They're playing the long game. They started planning this. This started before Shelby V. Holder. Shelby V. Holder just made it okay for them to pull the doors off.
Right.
But these guys are ready.
They are fixing it every step of the way, and we need to finally stand up and say, you know what, this is not all right. We need to do what Obama didn't do, and Biden needs to say, this is not okay. You can't say that if you guys take back the Senate, that you will not let me nominate a Supreme Court justice in 2024 if an opening comes up. That's not how it works. And again, that's nowhere in this Constitution. Anyway, I'm going to run because I have our guest standing by, but call back tomorrow. We'll chat. Okay?
I will. Love you.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. All right. So, sorry about that, Abdallah. I have the pot up, and if somebody calls in and you can hear it, I feel guilty that, you know, so anyway, Abdallah Fayyad, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yeah, that's right. And thanks for inviting me on your show.
Thank you so much for joining us. I've been talking about this for a few days now. This six-part editorial in the Boston Globe, which, you know, thank you for doing this, because we so definitely need to make sure that a Donald Trump doesn't happen again. And so you guys at the Boston Globe editorial board put this six-part series together on, what did you call it?
Future-proofing the presidency.
Future-proofing the presidency, right. I just didn't have it in front of me. Future-proofing the presidency. I really thought, and color me naive, at the beginning of the Trump campaign, there's no way the Republican Party would let him get the nomination, certainly wouldn't let him ascend to the presidency. I mean, there have to be stops in there somewhere where they can, you know, stop it. And that never happened. Were you as surprised as I was?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the nation was surprised by Donald Trump's rise. Not necessarily because his ideology was, you know, considered fringe at the time, but because he was such an extraordinarily unprepared and unqualified person to lead the country. And, you know, he was ridden with scandal after scandal. And so he didn't fit the political narratives that we were used to. So I think a lot of people were surprised. But, you know, hindsight is 2020. And, you know, when we look back at that time, you know, it makes a lot of sense, you know, that Donald Trump would succeed, you know, for the Republican Party. You know, he was the culmination, you know, of decades, you know, of work by the Republican Party, you know, to attack civil rights, attack voting rights, you know, and kind of promote their agenda, you know, in a very effective way, mm-hmm. That gave rise to extremists and extremism. And you know, they created a space in their party for a lot of white supremacists to feel comfortable, for a lot of racists to feel like, you know, promoting racist ideas is something that is acceptable. And so Donald Trump is the natural culmination of that. He just happened to be very brazen and nonchalant about it all, which is why it was so shocking.
Right, but here's here's the thing. I mean,
he was also a little surprised at the time that it actually happened.
Yes, most definitely. He did not expect to win. In fact, the whole stop the steal nonsense, they had that ready to roll out in 2016 when he lost to Hillary Clinton. This is all nonsense. It's not real. It was a marketing campaign that they had ready to go 4 years ago, and then he won against all common sense. And they're like, oh, we don't need this. And they threw it in a drawer and pulled it out 4 years later when he did lose. And the fact that so many Americans just don't see it, that they're taken in by this con man, is it's really sad more than anything else. But here's the other thing. The other candidates in that primary that had started out with like 58 people or something like that, there weren't other white supremacists up there spouting that stuff. Steve King even got basically thrown out of the party for doing it. Now it gets you embraced to be president. But back then, it wasn't so widely accepted. It just shows the Republicans will back anything as long as it keeps them in power, no matter how reprehensible or gross it is to them. They have no morals. They have
Know that it wasn't that, you know, that it wasn't necessarily accepted. You know, even the 2016 primaries, you know, the supposed moderate candidates were espousing views that were pretty extreme, yeah. You know. So, for example, Jeb Bush was, you know, supposed to be the most, one of the most moderate ones. You know, and he was somebody who said, for example, that he would only accept Syrian refugees if they are Christian. And so, of course, Donald Trump took that to the extreme and wanted to implement a Muslim ban. But that kind of idea that Muslims aren't worthy of seeking refuge in the United States, despite, you know, facing, you know, these humanitarian crises, you know, that was something espoused by the moderate wing of the party. They had, you know, and Jeb Bush was kind of somebody who, you know, a lot of the pundits considered to be, you know, more progressive on immigration in his party. You know, Ted Cruz, you know, in that horrible same primary, yes, also wanted to surveil Muslim neighborhoods and mosques in the United States. Yep, so, yep, you know, this kind of ideology was getting a lot of traction in the Republican Party after they lost in 2012. You know, they kind of had two paths to go to after Mitt Romney lost. And when Mitt Romney lost, they could either, you know, move towards the center and try to broaden their coalition so they could win elections fairly, or they could double down on white identity politics and kind of, you know, just turn out as many people as they can get and suppress as many people as they can. And so, you know, you started to see that shift happen, and, you know, it was a delicate dance for a lot of them. But, you know, it was definitely there. But Donald Trump was certainly the one who was most, you know, outspoken about it. I think the closest to Donald Trump, the closest precedent to Donald Trump, you know, in the mainstream Republican Party was Sarah Palin's nomination as the vice presidential candidate in 2008.
That definitely paved the way. And the way she talked, and I think, you know, maybe at the beginning, the Republican Party was a bit taken aback by it, but they saw that she generated excitement. And that's what they went with. Anything that'll get them to a win, anything that'll get them to power, doesn't matter if it's wholly untrue or, you know, what they do makes stuff up all the time. It doesn't matter. It got them to their end result, which was winning the presidency. And now, you know, you have Mitch McConnell today saying that if they take back the Senate, that then in 2024, even if there's an opening, too bad, you know, Democrats, well, again, will not be able to fill that seat, which is appalling. And I hope everybody is listening really carefully and will remember that, because we need as many people to get out and vote in every election going forward as they did last time. So you have this thing, how to future-proof the presidency. And at the beginning, the editorial board writes, Donald Trump exposed the weaknesses in our system of government that can now be exploited by a corrupt leader with control of the White House. In this series, the Globe editorial board outlines the urgent reforms needed to prevent the rise of an American tyrant and to protect our democracy for posterity. And you talk about the key presidential reforms that would prevent a future authoritarian president, perhaps one more competent than Trump, which is an important distinction, from abusing power and subverting our democracy. So you split it up into six parts. And in fact, you go right in on the first one. The first one's called Treasure Map for an American Tyrant. And he basically talked about the deep shit that Trump's financial situation is. He was way in debt when he took office, despite the lies, but there was a reason why he never showed his tax returns.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was one of the, you know, most, you know, brazenly committed abuses of power that Donald Trump, you know, kind of had. You know, we never saw his tax returns. And of course, there's no law that requires presidents to release their tax returns. So technically, he didn't do anything illegal in his lack of disclosure there. But, you know, it was just completely unethical. You know, we had a president who was at least $400 million in debt. And, you know, had he won a second term, you know, most of that would have been due during his second term, which right. would have set up the United States to be in a position where its president would be in, you know, unprecedented conflict of interest.
Right.
You know, and he would have to then, you know, we would imagine put his own self-interest, as he did over the last 4 years, over that of the country's. So, I mean, you know, it definitely wasn't the most, you know, extreme abuse of power. He incited an insurrection and an attack on the country. You know, he obstructed justice more than once. He tried to cheat in the election multiple times. He tried to undermine the post
Still
office.
Does,
I mean, he
yeah.
was abusing his power almost every single month of his presidency. But, you know, his financial conflicts of interest set a very dangerous precedent for the United States, because never before had the United States elected, a president who had a sprawling business empire, you know,
and wouldn't give it up. That's the thing.
Right.
We've had wealthy presidents before who've stepped back, who've done what they're supposed to do, but not Trump.
Exactly. And that's part of, you know, why we dove into that. And you know, when it came to financial conflicts of interest, one of the steps that we're asking Congress to take is to require presidents to divest from businesses that they own when they assume office
right.
in order to avoid these conflicts of interest. You know, in the end, presidents are such a central part of the American government that it's hard to root out every conflict of interest. But that's why you need multiple safeguards. One of them is to divest from their businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is to disclose their tax returns
that's
so that,
right.
you know, if they do have a political conflict of interest or financial one, then, you know, we, the voters of the United States, can at least know whether or not, you know, they have a conflict of interest and evaluate them on whether or not they're acting on it. And so
Absolutely.
We do have to implement these new safeguards to protect ourselves. You know, you can't look at the Trump presidency without and his reaction to losing mm-hmm. Without taking into consideration that his own, you know, financial well-being was on the line and possibly, you know, legal well-being was
That's
also
right.
on the line after he lost the election. So that's a critical factor in understanding the Trump presidency and his reckless, you know, undermining of democracy after he lost in 2020.
Abdallah Fayyad is with us. He's from the Boston Globe's editorial board. And we're talking about this, I think, historic 6-part editorial series that wraps up today. How to future-proof the presidency. The second installment was who owns the president? And this is interesting because you're right. The 45th president was in bed financially with foreign governments, a precedent for America's enemies to wield influence over the Oval Office. And then you say within 3 days of Trump's being sworn in, Crew, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, filed a lawsuit to prevent Trump from illegally receiving money from foreign governments. But he did it anyway. Talk about the Saudi government and what happened right after he took office and after that.
Yeah, so, you know, the minute that we found out that Donald Trump had won the election in 2016, back in November, we knew that the United States had now entered a path, you know, towards, you know, an unprecedented time, you know, and conflicts of interest for the president, and probably that the president would, and the president-elect, who would then assume office, would violate the Constitution on his very first day in office. And so the reason for that is, you know, we have the emoluments clauses in the Constitution that, you know, bans presidents from receiving money or gifts from foreign or domestic governments. And by virtue of not divesting in his businesses, Donald Trump was receiving, you know, money from foreign governments, you know, before he became president, between the time he was elected and the time he was sworn in, and then throughout his time in office, as well as, you know, from our own government, the Secret Service. Yep. He spent millions of dollars on his properties and businesses, and he was, you know, his businesses were raking that money in, and that's taxpayer money.
That's right.
And so he was in violation of the Constitution from the very first day he was in office. The Saudi government, in that transition period in 2016 to 2017, you know, booked like 500 hotel rooms in his Washington, D.C. hotel. You know, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, and that they were, you know, plainly currying favor, mm-hmm. With the 45th president of the United States, you know. And then we saw him, you know, take certain steps with Saudi Arabia that, you know, we can't say directly that influenced his behavior with Saudi Arabia, but it was definitely a factor that, you know, voters have to evaluate. Beyond that as well, you know, there were other governments that, you know, paid his properties, you know, money for their, you know, they had apartments in his buildings, yep. You know, fees and things like
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
And he, you know, never, throughout his time in office, he was receiving
the whole time. And all of these emoluments cases apparently are going nowhere, unless you know something that I don't. It looks like judges have just thrown them out. Well, it's moot now because he's no longer in office and he can't, you know, he can't bilk the people anymore. Well, how about holding him accountable for what he did? And oh, how interesting that his lease on the hotel in Washington, D.C. is now for sale, because he can't fill it. The only reason he filled it was because he was in the White House and people were paying, foreign governments were paying to curry favor with him. If you can't see that, then you're blind. It's so frustrating. So number three, we know where this one goes, assorted family affair. Can you spell nepotism? T-R-U-M-P. And it's amazing. You talk about even, you know, they made a big deal of Ivanka and Jared and Donald not taking their salaries. They cleaned up taking in money while they were in the White House. They directly benefited from both the tax cuts and everything else he did. It was all, it seemed to me, choreographed to put money in their pockets.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, they did. I mean, Jared Kushner's family explicitly used their relationship with the president's son-in-law, yep. You know, while they were, you know, doing trips, drawing investors into their own real estate company, and leaning on their ties, you know, with Jared Kushner, saying, if you invest, you know, we will help fast track your visa programs to the United States. I mean, that directly benefited, you know, the president's son-in-law's business, family businesses. Yep. You know, the president's son-in-law also, Jared Kushner, didn't divest from another business until it directly benefited from the tax cuts that his father-in-law signed into law. So, you know, the corruption seeped through his family members. They weren't there to serve the country. They very much, you know, used the presidency as a money-making enterprise. But here's the dangerous part of Donald Trump's nepotism that people have to take very seriously. It wasn't just a matter of petty corruption and self-enrichment. It put the American people in danger. These are people who were appointed to positions with no prior experience, and there's virtually no way they would have gotten those jobs.
Never.
Had they not had that close relationship with the president. Jared Kushner, in particular, you know, was overseeing, you know, negotiations in the Middle East while his family business was doing business the Middle East. You know, Jared Kushner was part of the leadership of the government's coronavirus response team.
Oh, God.
You know, overseeing one of the worst coronavirus responses in the world.
That's right.
With hundreds of thousands of Americans now dead. And so, you know, there were real costs to not having enough enforcement mechanisms in place and safeguards in place to protect our democracy from nepotism at the highest levels of government. You know, and so that's why, you know, we called for strengthening the enforcement of nepotism laws.
Yes.
And, you know, you just also have to think about this as, you know, it's virtually impossible to form the most competent government if you're hiring relatives or friends who aren't necessarily the most qualified people for the job.
Right. Yeah, it is astounding. It really is astounding. The next installment is hiding the evidence. This is the obstruction of justice section. And it is astounding. And you're right. Out of the gate, Donald Trump broke the law and brazenly admitted it, not with remorse, but with pride and conviction. Then, you go through within 4 months, he fired the FBI director. He was, rebuffed the Department of Justice's everything he was told to do by the people who knew what they were doing. He rebuffed. They denied subpoenas. They just said our system of checks and balances doesn't exist anymore because you can't enforce anything. And that's why I was glad. I mean, not glad that it happened, but glad to see you guys at the Boston Globe spell it out. You wrote, as it stands, Trump's presidency will only embolden future presidents to abuse their power because he showed impeachment to be a far less threatening tool than it once was. They even took being impeached twice and poo-pooed it. No big deal. This is a twice impeached president. It's a big deal, but they live in opposite world. This is the place where I talk about where, up is down, red is green, the sky is purple. This is where they live. And if you say anything different, they will gaslight you into thinking that you're the crazy one. So what do we do? How do we get checks and balances back in our government? How do we give Congress back the responsibility of oversight of the executive branch?
This is one thing that we wanted to focus on in the series, is that, Donald Trump didn't destroy the presidency and he didn't, necessarily wreck it on his own. What he did most successfully was expose, the weaknesses in our checks and balances against a tyrannical president, that we simply don't have a system and that we don't have the tools that we need in order to enforce our anti-corruption norms and laws against presidents who are, unwilling to be bound by them. By just tradition. That's what we're trying to shore up in this series. And so, in this part, we're looking at bolstering accountability measures for the president. So, we want to bolster oversight. Mm-hmm. So one is to, increase Congress's capacity to play its role as, as a branch of government that oversees the executive branch. And so we want to, strengthen Congress's subpoena powers by, allowing them to issue fines, fast track court proceedings.
I thought that they already had that. I thought that they could levy fines, and I thought that they could even get the sergeant at arms to go and pick up somebody. There's apparently a jail cell somewhere in the basement of the Capitol, but they didn't do any of that. They just went, oh, well, they're going to ignore our subpoenas. What are we going to do?
Part of that is because, people ignore subpoenas, they can get stuck, in the courts and it takes a while to actually, be able to, forcibly bring someone in to testify. Right. And so one of the things we want to do is to fast track court proceedings. We want to strengthen whistleblower protections. Another thing that we want to do is we were asking the Department of Justice to revisit its 1973 memo from the Office of Legal Counsel, which Robert Mueller, the former special counsel, operated under, which dictated that you cannot indict a sitting president.
Right. And this is not a rule. It's not a law. It was like a memo. It was somebody's opinion who did, it was nothing enforceable. And they're treating it as if it is the law of the land.
That's exactly right. It's not the law of the land. It's not in the Constitution. There is nothing in our laws that says you cannot indict a sitting president. The reasoning behind that memo is interesting in that, they did not want a president to be incapacitated by having to go through a criminal trial. But what we're suggesting is that the Department of Justice should be able to indict a corrupt president on charges of corruption. Absolutely. Or abuses of power, anything that doesn't meet the threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors. So, we cannot just have a standard where the president is only punished by Congress if they commit high crimes and misdemeanors. What if they, partake in petty corruption or just break, laws that do not meet the threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors? We need to have our institutions be able to indict a sitting president. And what we're suggesting is then defer the criminal criminal trial till after they're out of office.
Right.
Because, you know, as we do with everybody, we have to presume innocence until they're proven guilty. And we shouldn't incapacitate a president by wrangling the White House into a criminal trial. But, you know, defer the trial until they're out of office. And then you will have, you know, you would reintroduce, you know, deterrence in the White House.
Sure.
And would deter future presidents and even presidents who abuse their power in the first place from abusing their power again, because they know they're going to be held accountable for them, that there will be legal consequences for their presidential misconduct.
Like they're doing in Israel right now, because now that Netanyahu's out, he's got something like 30 some odd indictments waiting for him, waiting until he got out of office. There's no reason we couldn't do that here. The next two are just as important. You have rewards for doing the president's bidding, and this is about pardons, and we've seen the clown show that surrounds Trump and how all these people got rewarded for doing the president's bidding. And then the last one is the case for prosecuting Trump. I'm rushing because we've only got a couple minutes left. But here's my question. I love all the suggestions. You make real good recommendations, things we need to do to, yes, future-proof the presidency. Problem is, these all take legislation. And we have a Republican Party who will do nothing of the sort. They will not strengthen the oversight of Congress for the presidency because they think that they're going to regain it. I don't understand. I don't understand anything about today's Republican Party. But how do we get this done with Mitch McConnell as the Senate Minority Leader?
Of course, you know, we're not blind to the fact that the Republican Party is an obstructionist one and is unlikely to participate in these kinds of reforms on a mass level. But there has to be some Republicans who are interested in passing anti-corruption reform, because corruption doesn't know a single party. And that's something we wanted to make clear in the series. You know,
yep.
Corrupt presidents have come from both parties.
That's right.
And both parties will continue to be corrupt in the White House and abuse their power. Power corrupts, and you have to prevent presidents of the United States from abusing their power. And one lesson that we learned from the Trump presidency is that you can actually do anything in the White House and you will get away with it. Because, you know, while we have had crooked presidents in the past, none before Donald Trump actually incited, a coup, coup on American democracy, in which five people died.
Yes.
If Donald Trump gets away with that, you know, the message that sends to future presidents is that you can do anything and you can get away with it. And so, you know, anyone who has interest in restraining Democrats from abusing their power in office to Republicans abusing their power in office, this ought to be a bipartisan cause. Anti-corruption ought to be a bipartisan cause because it's not a single party that is committing, you know, abuses of power. If you want to protect American democracy, if that's something you're actually interested in protecting, and there are some Republicans who say they're interested in protecting it, and that said, they're in single digits.
Right. I was going to say, but can you find 10?
That's yeah. But, you know, at the same time, it's not going to be easy. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, this kind of reform is not easy, but people have to muster. And this is what we're asking, is that people muster the political courage to do it. It shouldn't take courage, to pass anti-corruption norms and laws. In fact, all it requires is shamelessness to allow, American democracy to rot or crumble under your watch. And that's what's happening. So something needs to change.
Without a doubt. So did you send a copy of this? I'm sure you had some special presentations printed up, I would guess, because it's an amazing thing you put together here at the Boston Globe. Did you send a copy to everybody in Congress?
Well, thanks so much for the kind words. We haven't sent a copy to members of Congress directly, but we have had lawmakers, some lawmakers share the series and take it seriously. Still no Republicans, but hopefully they will read it and reach out, we are hoping that this makes an impact with Congress, that they read it and take it seriously. This, again, is not a partisan issue.
No.
This is something that both parties have to take very seriously if they want to, you know, protect American democracy and not have America, you know, fall towards the autocracy or the path towards autocracy that Donald Trump put it on.
Without a doubt. I got one more very quick question for you. Is the editorial board, did you all sit around and did you split it up into six pieces and say, all right, this group works on this one, this group works on this one? Is that how it came together? Or Was it?
No, our meetings at the editorial board are all off the record. So, I'm not at liberty to discuss.
You have to kill me. I get it.
But, you know, everything that we do is a group effort, and we do deliberate over our ideas and our arguments together. And so this was, the editorial board's over deliberations, and we made careful evaluations and conclusions as to what recommendations we should make for Congress and the Biden administration, to take right now in order to protect our democracy.
Gotcha. Abdallah Fayyad, you can find him on Twitter at @Abdallah_Fayyad. I'll put links to him, to the Boston Globe, to this series on the blog at NicoleSandler.com/6-14-21, because that's today's date. That's where they're posted. It'll be with the show. Thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. And I love what you guys did. Everybody needs to read this.
Thanks so much, Nicole. I really appreciate your interest in the series, and thanks for covering it.
My pleasure. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. With that, we're done. That's today. But stick around. I think we've already lost the Progressive Voices Network because I tend to run long. I try to take it right up to the, Anyway, thank you to Abdallah. And now I will leave you with the news, because there was a lot of news today that I didn't get to during the show. So here we go.
I read the news today. Oh, boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The nation marked the 5th anniversary of the Pulse nightclub massacre on Saturday. So far this year, we've had 272 mass shootings, and it's only June. From Friday afternoon until Sunday, at least 9 people were killed and another 47 injured in 8 mass shootings across 6 states. The total number of mass shootings is about 40% higher than at this point in 2020 and about 65% higher than in 2019. Sickening. Well, the group of 7 leaders closed their 3-day summit in England on Sunday with a statement criticizing China for its human rights record and the erosion of Hong Kong's autonomy, while demanding that Beijing thoroughly and transparently investigate the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. The G7, a group of wealthy democracies that includes the United States, Canada, Japan, Germany, Italy, France, and the UK, also formally pledged to donate more than 1 billion COVID-19 vaccine doses to poorer nations, and they agreed in principle to a minimum corporate tax. Some global health advocates also called for bolder action against the pandemic and climate change. That would be nice. President Biden and First Lady Jill Biden had tea at Windsor Castle with Queen Elizabeth at the end of their UK visit on Sunday. Biden said the Queen asked about the leaders of China and Russia, and he said that he had invited her to the White House. Next stop for Biden is Brussels, where on Monday he attends the 31st NATO summit, his first one as president. Now, the former guy frequently railed against NATO, but Biden has reiterated his support of NATO and its goals of transatlantic security and collective defense. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that countries at Monday's summit will agree to the group's 2030 agenda, focused on strengthening collective defenses, strengthening resilience, sharpening their technological edges, and working with like-minded partners. They'll also talk about ways to approach Russia. Good timing, since Biden is due to meet with Vladimir Putin on Wednesday. More international news, as Israeli lawmakers on Sunday voted 60-59 to install a new coalition government, finally ousting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after a record 12 years in power. The incoming coalition includes parties from the right, center, and left. It'll be led for the next 2 years by Naftali Bennett, an orthodox leader of Israel's very religious right-wing nationalist movement. After 4 elections in 2 years, Bennett's incoming government breaks a long political deadlock and ushers in the most diverse coalition Israel has ever seen. And it includes the first Arab party to serve in the Israeli government. Netanyahu, channeling his buddy Donald, is fighting his defeat. Ahead of the swearing-in, Netanyahu denounced the coalition that ousted him from office, calling it a weak and dangerous government, saying it wouldn't be able to stand up to global rivals like Iran. And he said, "We'll be back soon." But now he'll have to face all those indictments that have piled up around him. Here at home, last week we learned about the overreach and excesses from the Trump Justice Department with the New York Times article about revelations that the Trump DOJ had seized the data of reporters and at least two Democrats in Congress as part of their investigation into leaks regarding contacts between Trump World and Russia. As is usually the case, there's more where that came from. Now we learn that the Trump DOJ had also subpoenaed data from one of Don McGahn's accounts back in February of 2018. A gag order just expired, finally allowing Apple to inform McGahn of what incursions they made into his private accounts. According to Apple, the Justice Department said at the time that it was barred from informing McGahn, whose wife also received a similar notice. It wasn't immediately clear which accounts were reviewed or whether McCann, who had been the 2016 Trump campaign's top lawyer, was the focus of the matter the Justice Department was investigating. Now to try to get some answers. Today, leaders from CNN, The New York Times, and The Washington Post are meeting with U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland to discuss the Trump administration's controversial leak investigation. Democrats are demanding sworn testimony from Trump's former attorneys general involved in the scandal. The New York Times reporting Monday morning that John Demers, a Trump appointee who remained in the Biden Justice Department, who would have typically been briefed on investigations like those involving the secret collection of journalists' phone records, is stepping down. Interesting how that works, isn't it? While many of us are gingerly rejoining the outside world after about 15 months of seclusion, a new, more dangerous COVID-19 variant is on the rise here in the United States and could do serious damage in areas with low vaccination rates. It's the Delta variant. It currently accounts for about 10% of U.S. COVID-19 infections, but that proportion is doubling every 2 weeks. And it may become the dominant strain here in the U.S. That might not mean a sharp uptick in infections across the country because we've administered more than 309 million doses of the vaccine. But specific regions are at risk. In states like Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Wyoming, which are showing significantly lower vaccination rates than the national average of 64.4%. This is no time to let down your defenses. And finally, we knew this was coming. A driver killed at least one person and injured at least three others Sunday night at a protest in Minneapolis over the police killing of yet another black man. This appears to be a rising trend. More than 100 people were struck by cars last year during Black Lives Matter protests. And Republican legislatures in multiple states have introduced measures that would grant immunity to drivers who strike and injure protesters with their vehicles. What did they expect would happen? And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.